tell you, we have to get over the mountains, all the way over. Then we get to the San Joaquin and we're on level ground, and we can cut over to Sequoia.
Let's get a map, Harvey suggested.
It doesn't show on a map, Mark protested. If it did, everybody...
I believe your road, Harvey said. I want to see what happens after that. I've got maps in the travel hall. He started to turn, but Joanna went to the motorcycle. She reached into a saddlebag.
Frank Stoner made us take 3 copies, 1 for each bike, she said.
She held up a big aeronautical chart. It showed terrain features in colors.
There are auto club maps, too.
It was too dark to read the map properly. Mark went to the travel hall and came back with a flashlight. Marie was standing stiffly aloof, silent, her eyes still accusing.
See? Mark said. Right across here. The highway goes past lakes, with dams, that sit on top of the San Andreas. You really think the big highway's still usable?
Harvey shook his head. It wouldn't matter. If the highway could be used, 1 million people would be trying to use it. If not... So we come out through Fraser Park.
Right. Then down in the valley, and it's a straight shot north, Mark said. I was thinking of getting to the Mojave, because that's where Frank said we should be, but it's no good. Can't get to Sequoia that way, he pointed. All the east side routes lead past Lake Isabella. Follow the Kern River. Harv, with all this rain, how many bridges will there be over the Kern?
None. Marie, he's right. If we went the direct route, we'd never get there. Mark looked pleased. Joanna leaned the shotgun against the bike and collapsed onto the seat, side saddle.
If you had explained before, Marie began.
Jesus, I tried!
Mark shouted.
Not you.
She meant me, Harvey thought. And she's right. I can't curl up and die. I've got a boy up in those hills and I've got to go get him. And thank God for Marie. How's our gas? Harvey asked.
Pretty good. We've made about 50 miles.
No more than that, Harvey muttered. Of course it was true. He could see it on the map. It seemed like much further. They couldn't have been going very fast. Mark, how sure are you of this fire trail? Won't it wash out?
Probably, Mark said.
He pointed silently to the dams poised above Interstate 5.
Rather risk that.
No. If we're going, we'd better do it.
I'll drive, Harvey said.
And I'll scout ahead. Joanna can ride shotgun with you.
Mark didn't mention Marie. He wasn't speaking to her. It felt good to be doing something. Anything. He had a throbbing headache, the beginning of a migraine, and his shoulders and neck were so tense he could feel knots in them. But it was better than curling up in the seat. Let's go, Harvey said. The road ran along ridgelines, curled around hills, boring north and west. It stayed on high ground. Rock and mudslides spilled across it, but being high, the debris wasn't deep, and being almost untraveled, the road wasn't cut away at the edges. The mountains had shifted. The road might have ended anywhere. Like Mark Chescu's judgment, it was nothing you could count on, absolutely. But neither had failed them this time. Eventually, they came to paved road, and Harvey could increase his speed. He liked driving. He drove with single-minded determination, with no room for other thoughts. Watch for rocks. Ease around curves. Keep going. Rack up the miles. On, and never look back, and never think about what's behind you. Down and down now, into the San Joaquin. Water standing everywhere. That was frightening. Harvey stopped and looked at the map. Their way ran directly to a dry lake bed. It wouldn't be dry now. So cross the Kern on the freeway, then get off and cut northeast. Would their gas hold? They had plenty so far. Harvey thought of the extra gas he'd stored, and of thieves and killers in a blue van. Wherever they hid, someday he would track them down. But they hadn't taken this road. He'd have noticed. So far, they'd had the road almost to themselves. Dawn found them north and east of Bakersfield. They'd made effective progress, 30 miles an hour, and now they were on high ground, skirting the eastern edge of the San Joaquin, with nothing to stop them. Harvey realized where they were heading. Their route would take them right past the Jellison Ranch.
The Tule River was too deep, way too deep. Nobody had dared to use the road that ran alongside. By the time Harvey realized this, it was too late. He could see the dam ahead. Water streamed around one side and all along the top. He could just tell where the spillway was, a surging current in the river that poured over the face of the dam. He sounded the horn and waved Mark ahead. He clenched his fist and moved it vigorously up and down, the army signal for double time. He pointed at the dam. Mark got the message. He gunned the bike. Harvey slammed down the accelerator and roared after him. They were almost to the dam. Then a river of mud submerged the road. A dozen people and half that many cars were mired in the mud. They tried to get past the slide and got stuck. Harvey levered the travel all into four-wheel drive and went on without stopping. One man stepped forth to bar their way with spread arms. Harvey came close enough to see wide eyes and bared teeth, a rictus of terror and determination. And he saw Harvey's face. The travel-all's headlight ticked his heel as he leaped away. The mud was sliding, and the travel-all slid with it. Harvey turned hard, gunned the engine, and fought a frantic race between his traction on the mud and the mud's adherence to the road. Rocks in the road tipped the travel-all sickeningly. Then there was road under them again. Harvey heard Marie's gasp of relief. There was a bridge ahead. It crossed an arm of the lake, and it was under water. Harvey couldn't tell how deep. He slowed. Suddenly, there were other sounds embedded in the sounds of river and rain and thunder. Screams. Joanna looked back. "Jesus!" she shouted. Harvey stopped the travel-all. The dam was going. One whole side of it crumbled, all in a moment, and the lake went forth in a wall of water. The screams were drowned in its thunder.
"Our timing was superb," Joanna said.
"All those people," Harvey muttered. "All the travelers in cars not as good as the travel-all. All the farmers who thought they'd wait it out. People on foot, people already marooned on roofs and high points in the new shallow lakes, would look up to see the wall of water marching toward them. It would be worse when the other dams went. The whole valley would be flooded. No dam would hold against this relentless rain." Harvey took a deep breath.
"Okay, it's over. We made it. Quaking Aspen is only 30 miles from here. Gordy'll bring them out there."
He summoned up a mental picture of the road north of Springville. It crossed many streams, and the map showed small power stations and dams on some of them. Dams above the road. Had they failed? Would they fail? It would be foolish, even insane, to charge up the road just in time to be washed down again.
"Let's go," Marie said.
Harvey drove on. There was no water above the bridge now. That water was on its way into the San Joaquin Valley. He drove across the bridge and was surprised to see a big truck coming toward him. It stopped just at the far end of the bridge. Two big men got out. They stared as Harvey drove past them. One started to shout something, then shrugged. Up ahead, there was another bridge out. That decided it. Harvey had to detour past the entrance to Senator Jellison's place. And where better to learn what was happening in the mountains? For that matter, where would they go once they found the boys? Marie hadn't thought past the moment of finding Bert and Andy. Neither had Harvey until now, but this was perfect. The scout troop would have to come past the Jellison place. And Maureen would be there. Harvey despised himself for thinking of her. Loretta's face swam in front of him, and the vision of a body wrapped in an electric blanket. He slowed to a stop.
"Why are we—"
Before Marie could finish, there was an explosion behind them, then another.
"What the hell?"
Harvey started the car again. Remorse was replaced by fear. Explosions. Had they wandered into a range war or something? He drove ahead while Joanna and Marie craned to look back. Mark whipped the bike into a U-turn and drove back the way they'd come. He waved as he went past. "Damn fool curiosity will kill him yet," Joanna said. Harvey shrugged. He could stand not knowing, but it would be nice to find out. Up ahead, a couple of miles, not far at all, was the turnoff. Then safety, refuge, rest. He drove slowly, and he'd just reached the senator's drive when he saw Mark coming up behind him. He pulled to a stop.
"That bridge," Mark said.
"Yeah?"
"The one we came over," Mark said. "Those two dudes just blew it. Dynamite, I think. They dropped it at both ends. Harvey, a half hour later and we'd be stranded back there."
2 minutes later, Joanna said, and we'd have been looking up at a million tons of water.
Harv, we can't keep lucking out like this."
"It takes luck," Harvey said. "In combat here, luck's as important as brains. But we won't need any more for a while. I'm going in there." He waved toward the senator's drive.
"Why?"
Marie demanded, ready for war. "Road conditions. Information." Harvey drove on to the gate. It was only just coming to him. It had never occurred to him, not for an instant, that a master of television documentaries might not be welcome at a politician's home. He got out to open the gate. There was a car parked inside. A young man got out and wearily came to the travel-all.
"Your business?"
he inquired. He eyed Joanna and the shotgun, showed his empty hands.
"Me, I'm not armed, but my partner's where you can't see him, and he's got a scope-sighted rifle."
"We'll be no trouble," Harvey said. The man had seen the NBS markings on the travel-all, and he hadn't been impressed. "Can you get a message up to the big house?"
"Depends on the message. Might."
Harvey had thought it through.
"Tell Maureen Jellison that Harvey Randall is here with three dependents."
The man looked thoughtful.
"Well, you got the names right. She expecting you?"
Harvey laughed. It struck him as insanely funny. He leaned against the fender and chortled. He put a hand on the man's arm and got control of his voice and said,
"From Los Angeles?"
and lost it again. The man withdrew a little. His large red face blanked out. There were things he didn't want to know. But the senator had told the meeting he'd like to talk to someone who'd seen what happened to L.A., and this city man did know the senator's name, and Maureen's as well. As suddenly as it had been funny, suddenly it wasn't. Harvey stopped laughing.
"Maureen must think I'm dead. She'll be glad to know different.
Or will she?
Shazam. I know she'll want to talk to me. Tell her I want to... Never mind."
He'd been about to say he wanted to talk about galactic empires, and that wasn't the right thing to say at all. The man looked thoughtful. Finally, he nodded.
"Okay, I guess I can do that. But you wait right here.
I mean, right here. Understand? And don't get gay with that shotgun.
We don't want to shoot anybody. I just want to talk to Maureen."
"Okay.
Right there. I'll be a while."
He went to the car, locked it, and walked up the driveway. Walked. Saving gasoline already. Yes, the senator had his place organized. Harvey went back to the travel-all. Marie tried to say something. He cut through her voice with practiced ease. "Spread the map." She thought it over, then did it. Harvey let his forefinger do the talking.
"The scouts are in this area. The only route out is right past here. They don't have to worry about these dams, here and here, because they don't have to stay on the road. We do, or else we walk. We're not equipped to walk it."
Marie thought that over. She glanced at her boots and fingered her jacket. She was ready to walk, and so was Harvey, but it made sense. Certainly if they had to walk, a few hours wouldn't make any difference.
"So we wait here?"
Joanna asked. Mark stuck his head in at the window.
"Sure, this is Senator Jellison's place. Thought I recognized it. Harv, that was smart, sending a message to the senator's daughter instead of him."
"Wait," Marie said.
"How long?"
"Christ, how the hell do I know?" Harvey exploded. "As long as they'll let us. This ranch is organized, have you noticed? And they've got food. That guard wasn't hungry. We'd like to feed the boys when they get here, not to mention ourselves."
Marie nodded in submission.
"The trouble is," Harvey continued, "how do we get them to let us in?
Blowing up that bridge might have been a subtle hint that they aren't welcoming refugees in this valley. We have to be useful, which means we promise to do whatever they want us to do, and no goddamn arguments about it. Marie, don't blow this for us. We're beggars here.
He waited for that to sink in before turning to Joanna. That applies to your shotgun. I don't know if you noticed the subtle hand motions of that guy who stopped us, but he was doing strange things with his hand. His left hand. I expect sticking him up wouldn't be a good idea.
I knew that, Joanna said.
Yes, Harvey turned to Mark. Let me do the talking. Mark looked hurt. Who'd got Harvey out of his bedroom and across the state, all the way up here? But he stood in the rain, water running off his jacket and into his boots, and waited in silence.
Company coming, Mark said finally. He pointed up the drive.
Three men on horseback, wearing yellow slickers and rain hats. One didn't ride very well. He clung grimly to the horse. When he came closer, Harvey recognized Al Hardy, Jellison's administrative assistant and political hatchet man.
Hatchet man, Harvey thought. That might be more literally true here than it had been in Washington.
Hardy dismounted and handed the reins to one of the mounted men. He came over to the travelall and peered inside.
Hello, Mr. Randall, he said.
Hello, Harvey waited tensely.
Who are these people?
He looked closely at Marie, but didn't say anything.
Hardy had met Loretta only once, months ago, Harvey thought.
When? A long time, anyway. And Marie Vance, never. But he knew she wasn't Loretta. A good memory for names and faces goes with the job of political advisor.
A neighbor, Harvey said, and two employees.
I see. And you came from Los Angeles. Do you know conditions in L.A.?
They do, Harvey said. He indicated Mark and Joanna. They saw the tidal wave come in.
I can let two of you come up, Hardy said. No more.
Then it's none, Harvey said. He said it quickly before he could say anything else.
Thanks, and we'll be on our way.
Wait, Hardy looked thoughtful. Okay. Hand me the shotgun. Slow, and don't point it at me.
He took the weapon and handed it to the original guard, who'd also dismounted.
Any more firearms?
This pistol. Harvey showed the Olympic target gun.
My, but that's pretty. Give it to me, too. You'll get them back if you're not staying.
Hardy took the weapon and thrust it into his belt.
Now make room for me in the back seat.
He climbed into the back seat, leaned out to speak so the others could hear.
You follow on that bike, he told Mark. Stay close. I'm taking them up, Gil. It's all right.
If you say so, the original guard said.
Let's go, Hardy told Randall. Drive carefully.
The gate swung open and Harvey drove through, followed by Mark, then, further behind, by the third man on horseback leading the two other horses.
Why not leave a horse for the guard? Harvey asked.
We have more cars than horses. Rather lose a car if some damn fool tries anything, Hardy explained.
Harvey nodded, and the car was there if anything urgent had to get up the hill. Obviously, his message hadn't been thought urgent enough to waste gasoline on. The travelall walked through the thick mud, and Harvey wondered just how long this drive would last. He went past the foreman's home and toward the big house at the top of the hill. The orange groves looked pitiful, many of the trees down from the high winds, but there was no fruit on the ground. Harvey approved. Maureen wasn't in the big front room. Senator Jellison was. He had maps spread across the big dining table, and lists and other papers covered card tables nearby. A bottle of bourbon stood on the table. It was nearly full. They left their boots out on the porch and came into the big stone house. The senator stood. He didn't offer his hand.
I'll give you a drink if you'll recognize in advance that it's not permanent, Jellison said. Long time ago, if you offered a man food and drink, that said you'd keep him as a guest. That's not decided yet.
I understand, Harvey said. I could use a drink.
Right. I'll take the women back to the kitchen stove. They'll appreciate a chance to dry off.
"Excuse my manners, ladies. I'm a bit rushed just now."
He waited until the girls were gone, then waved Harvey into a seat. Mark stood uncertainly at the door.
"You too," Jellison said. "Drink?"
"You know it," Mark said.
When the bottle was given to him, he poured an enormous drink into his glass. Harvey grimaced and examined the senator's face. There was no change of expression.
"Is Maureen all right?" Harvey asked.
"She's here," Jellison said.
"Where's your wife?" Harvey felt himself flushing.
"Dead. Murdered. She was in the house when some people decided to rob it. If you get word of a blue van escorted by chopped motorcycles..."
"Not on my list of priorities. Sorry about Mrs. Randall, though. So who have you got with you?"
"The tall woman is Marie Vance, my neighbor. Gordy Vance is at Quaking Aspen with a scout troop. He's got my son. I've got his wife."
"Uh-huh. She's elegant. Can she hike, or are those boots for show?"
"She can hike. She can also cook, and I can't leave her."
"Cooks I have. The others?"
"They saved my ass. I was ready to lie down and die after I found Loretta."
The whiskey warmed him, and Harvey felt the intensity of the senator's questioning. The man was judge and jury, and he wasn't going to take long to make his decision.
"Mark and Joanna found me and carried me along till I came back to life. They brought Marie, too. They're with me."
"Sure. Okay.
What are you trading?"
Harvey shrugged.
"A travel all I know how to use. Some, hell, a lot of experience surviving. Backpacking, war correspondent, helicopter pilot."
"You were in L.A. You saw it?"
"Mark and Joanna did. We have information, if that's useful."
"Information is worth a meal and a drink. You're telling me if I let you in, the others stay, too."
"Yes, I'm afraid that's it. We'll do our share, assuming you can feed us."
Jellison looked thoughtful.
"You've got one vote," he said. "Maureen's. But it's mine that counts."
"I figured that. I gather you aren't exactly welcoming refugees, the bridge and all."
"Bridge?"
"The big one over an arm of the lake, just after the dam went."
"Dam's gone?"
Jellison frowned.
"Al!" he shouted.
"Yes, sir."
Hardy came in quickly. His hand was in his raincoat pocket. It bulged. He relaxed at the sight of the three men seated in chairs, drinking calmly.
"He says the dam's gone," Jellison said. "Any word brought in on that?"
"Not yet."
"Yeah,"
Jellison nodded significantly. Hardy seemed to understand what he meant.
"Now tell me about the bridge," Jellison said.
"Two men blew it up just after the dam went. Dynamite, both ends."
"I will be dipped in shit. Describe the men."
Jellison listened, then nodded.
"Right. Christophers. We may have trouble with them."
He turned toward Mark. "Army?" he asked.
"Navy,"
Mark said.
"Basic? Can you shoot?"
"Yes, sir."
Mark began one of his tales about Nam. It might or might not have been true, but Jellison wasn't listening.
"Can he?"
he asked Randall.
"Yes, I've seen him," Harvey said.
He began to relax, to feel the knots unwind in his neck. It looked good. It looked as if the senator might want him.
"If you stay here, you're on my team," Jellison said. "Nobody else's. Your loyalty is to me."
"Understood," Harvey said. Jellison nodded.
"We'll give it a try."
As the Mediterranean waters recede from the drowned cities of Tel Aviv and Haifa, rainstorms lash the highlands of the Sudan and Ethiopia. Floodwaters cascade down the Nile to smash against the high Aswan Dam, already weakened by the earthquakes following Hammerfall. The dam bursts, joining 130 million acre-feet of water to the flooded river. The waters smash across the Nile Delta, through the ancient cities, across Cairo. The Great Pyramid is undermined and falls beneath the torrent. 10,000 years of civilization are scooped up and carried with the water. From the first cataract to the Mediterranean Sea, nothing lives in the delta of the Nile. Beggar Man. O hear us when we cry to thee for those in peril on the sea. Mariner's Hymn. Eileen slept with her seat tilted back to horizontal, her seatbelt loose about her. She rolled with the motion of the car. Once Tim heard the beginnings of a snore. He reached over and tightened her belt when they started on the long downgrade. Then he switched the motor off. He remembered his driver had done that in Greece. Everyone coasted down hills in Greece, even down the twisted narrow road from Delphi across Parnassus to Thermopylae. That had been terrifying, but the driver insisted. Greece had the most expensive gasoline in the world. Where was Thermopylae now? Had the waters washed away the grave of the 300? The waves wouldn't have reached Delphi or been as high as the Acropolis. Greece had lived through disasters before. The road twisted and tilted, and Tim eased the blazer around the turn, using the brakes warily. A long, straight stretch was ahead, down all the way, then more downhill on a wet and broken and twisting road, and riding with Eileen had made him realize just how good a driver he wasn't. The mountains had shifted. Here the road ended in space. Tim braked sharply and came to a stop. He walked forward through the soft rain. It tasted sweet. No more salt rain, anyway. The road and the steep bank of cut rock and this part of the mountain itself had sheared and dropped 20 feet or more. Mud had piled up below so that there were places where the drop was no more than 4 or 5 feet. Cars went over longer drops than that in TV commercials. One pickup ad had shown clips from a movie with that truck jumping over ditches, flying over banks, and the announcer had said the truck wasn't even especially modified. Would the blazer take it? Was there any choice? The drop looked as if it ran for miles. Tim got back in and backed up 50 yards. He thought through the physics of the situation. If the car fell over the edge, it would land on its nose, and they'd be dead. It had to go over horizontally, and that meant speed. Easing it over would kill them. He set the brake and walked back to the edge again. Wake Eileen. She was dead out of it. Headlights behind him, dim in the rain, decided it for him. He didn't know who that would be, and he didn't want to know. He walked back toward the blazer. His mind worked the equation. Call the blazer 15 feet long. It would fall at 1G. He got in and started the car. If the front end shouldn't fall more than 2 feet before the rear left the pavement, and also began to fall, then the whole car should be over in about a third of a second, which meant 15 feet in a third of a second, or 45 feet per second, and 44 feet per second was 30 miles per hour. So about 30 miles per hour ought to do it, and here we go. The car fell about 6 feet, all told. His instinct was to hit the brake, but he didn't. They hit hard, landing on the mud, rolling down the mud ramp onto the road itself. Amazingly, that was all. They were rolling down the road as if nothing had ever happened. Eileen bounced and rolled hard against the seatbelt. She shook herself, sat partly upright, and looked out. The wet countryside flowed past. She blinked, and then, satisfied, went back to sleep. Slept right through the best driving I'll ever do, Tim thought. He grinned at the rain and mud, then switched off the engine to coast downhill. An hour later, she was still asleep. He envied her. He'd heard of people who slept most of the time, shell-shocked or bitterly disappointed in their waking lives. He could understand the temptation, but of course that wasn't Eileen. She needed sleep. She'd be all the more alert when she was needed. Here, the road had shattered to discrete plates. Tim switched on the engine and kept the speed up, moving as if from island to concrete island. He remembered a TV program about the Baja race. One driver said the way to take a bad road was fast. That way you didn't touch the bumps, but flew over them. It hadn't seemed like a very good idea when he heard it, but now there didn't seem to be much else to do. The plates lurched under the car's weight and impact, Tim's knuckles were white on the wheel, but Eileen smiled in her sleep, as if rocked in a cradle. Tim felt very lonely. She had not deserted him. At the risk of her life, she had stayed with him. But she was sleeping, and he was driving, and the rain pounded constantly on metal an inch over his head, and the road kept doing strange things. Here it lifted in a graceful arc, like a futuristic bridge, and a new stream ran beneath it. The concrete ribbon hadn't shattered under its own weight. Not yet, but it for damn sure wouldn't hold a car. Tim drove around it through the flood. The wheels kept moving and the motor didn't die, and he pulled back onto the road where he could. He had been deserted by everything and everyone but Eileen. He could understand that money and credit cards were worthless, sure. A bullet through the windshield was something else. Driving across the green of a country club felt like vandalism. The observatory. But Tim didn't want to think about that. He'd been thrown off his own land, and his ears burned with the memory. Cowardice. It felt like cowardice. The road curled out of the mountains, widened, and became a smooth, straight line leading away. Where? No compass. Nothing to do but drive on. And the rain became a furious, lashing attack. Tim started the motor and dared to increase speed to 20 miles per hour. Eileen asked, "How are we doing?" "Out of the mountains. It's a straightaway. No brakes visible. Go back to sleep."
"Good."
When he looked, she was asleep again.
He saw a freeway ahead. A sign told him Highway 99, north. He went up the ramp. Now he could go 40. He passed cars stalled in the rain, both on and off the highway. People, too. Tim hunched low whenever he saw anything that could be a gun. Once it was real. Two men stepped out from either side of the highway and raised a pair of shotguns. They gestured, "Stop." Tim hunched low, stamped on the accelerator, aimed for one of the men. The man leaped unhesitatingly into the muddy darkness. Tim listened for the guns with every nerve, but they did not speak. Presently, he straightened up.
Now, what was that about? Were they afraid to waste ammunition? Or were the guns too wet to fire? He said to himself softly, "If you can't stand not knowing." Harv Randall's words. They still had gas. They were still moving. The highway was awash with water. It must have stopped lesser cars than this one. Tim grinned in the dark. 250 thou for a car. Well, it pays to buy the best. The rain hurled a sea of water across the land in one ferocious blast, then stopped just as suddenly. For a long moment, Tim had an unbroken view ahead. He hit the brakes as the rain slashed down again. The car achieved a marvelous floating sensation before it coasted to a stop. They had come to the end. Eileen sat up. She pulled the seat back up behind and smoothed her skirt with automatic gestures.
"We've hit an ocean," said Tim.
She rubbed her eyes.
"Where are we?"
Tim turned on the roof light. He spread the map across their laps.
"I kept working north and west and downhill," he said, "until we got out of the mountains. There were a lot of them. After a while, I couldn't tell directions anymore, so I just went downhill. Eventually, I came to Highway 99.
Tim spoke proudly. With his lousy sense of direction, they might have ended up anywhere.
99's been good. No more brakes. You missed a couple of guys with shotguns, and a lot of cars that weren't running anymore, but no real trouble. Of course, there was a lot of water on the road, but..."
She had raked the map with her eyes once. Now she was peering ahead through the rain, along the beam of the headlamps, piecing out the view from subliminal cues and imagination. For as far as they both could see in the gray twilight, there was nothing but a silver-gray expanse of rain-spattered water. No lights anywhere. Nothing.
"See if you can back up," she said.
She fell to studying the map. Tim inched backward out of the water until it was only hubcap deep.
"We're in trouble," Eileen said. "Have we passed Bakersfield?"
"Yes."
There had been freeway signs and the ghosts of dark buildings, a mountain range done all in right angles. "Not long ago."
She frowned and squinted at tiny print. It says Bakersfield is 400 feet above sea level. Tim remembered the fallen mountains. I wouldn't rely on elevations any longer. I seem to remember the entire San Fernando Valley dropped 30 feet during the Sylmar quake, and that was a little one. Well, everything gets lower and lower from here on. We're in the lowlands.
And we're sinking in the lowlands. Lowlands. Low.
Tim, no tidal wave could have gotten this far, could it?
No, but it's raining.
Raining? Ye gods, how it must have rained, and it's still coming. This wasn't all in the comet head, was it?
She shushed him when he started to explain.
Skip it. Let's rethink from scratch. Where do we want to go?
Back to high ground.
Well, Tim said, that's a problem, too. I know where we want to be. The high farming country, say around Sequoia National Forest.
What I don't know is why anyone would want us there. He didn't dare say anything else. She didn't say anything at all. She was waiting.
Tim worked on his nerve. I did have one idea.
She waited.
Damn, it was evaporating even as he tried to speak it. Like the restaurants and good hotels that waited in Tohunga. Speak your wish, and they were gone.
He said it anyway, a little desperately.
Senator Jellison's ranch. I contributed a lot of money to his campaign, and I've been to his ranch. It's perfect. If he's there, he'll let us in, and he'll be there. He's that smart. And you contributed money to his campaign, she chuckled. Money was worth good money then, and, honey, it's all I've got. Okay. I can't think of a single farmer who owes me anything. And the farmers own it all now, don't they? Just like Thomas Jefferson wanted it. Where is this ranch?
Tim tapped the map between Springville and Lake Success, just below the mountainous Sequoia National Park.
Here. We go underwater for a way, then we turn right and resume breathing. Maybe there's a better way. Look to your left. Do you see a railroad embankment?
He turned off the roof light, then the headlights. A little time for his eyes to adjust, and...
No. Well, it's there.
She was looking at the map.
Southern Pacific Railroad. Swing us around and point the headlights that way.
Tim maneuvered the car around.
What are you thinking of? Catching a train?
Not exactly. The headlights didn't reach far through the rain. They showed nothing but rain-stippled sea in all directions.
We'll have to take the embankment on faith, Eileen said. Slide over.
She climbed over him to reach the steering wheel. He couldn't guess what she had in mind, but he strapped down while she started the motor. Eileen turned south, back the way they had come.
There are people back there, he said. Two of them have shotguns. Also, I don't think we've got a siphon, so we shouldn't use up too much gas.
Good news from all over.
I'm just telling you, said Tim.
He noticed that the water was no longer hubcap deep. Off to the west, higher ground made black humps in the shallow sea. Here was a grove of almond trees, there a farmhouse, and Eileen turned sharp right where there was no road. The car settled as it left 99, then shouldered forward through water and mud. Tim was afraid to speak, almost afraid to breathe. Eileen wove a path that crossed one and another of the black humps of rising ground, but they weren't continuous. It was an ocean with islands, and they drove through it in an endless rainstorm. Tim waited with both hands braced on the dashboard for the car to plunge into some 2-foot dip and die.
There, Eileen muttered.
There.
Was the horizon slightly higher ahead? Moments later, Tim was sure. The land humped ahead of them. 5 minutes later, they were at the base of the railroad embankment. The car wouldn't climb it. Tim was sent out into the rain with the tow rope. He looped it under a rail and pulled back on it, leaning his weight above the embankment while Eileen tried to drive up sloping mud. The car kept sliding back. Tim looped the rope again around the other rail. He took in slack, inches at a time. The car would surge upward and start to fall back, and Tim would take up the slack and heave. One wrong move would cost him one finger. He had stopped thinking.
It was easier that way, in the dull misery of rain and exhaustion and the impossible task. His earlier triumphs were forgotten, useless. It came to him slowly that the car was up on the embankment, almost level, and Eileen was leaning on the horn. He detached the rope and coiled it and trudged back to the car. "Well done," Eileen said. He nodded and waited. If Tim's energy and determination were burned out, she still had hers. "A lot of cops know this trick. Eric Larson told me about it. I never tried it myself." The car lurched up onto a rail, backed and turned, tilting on the embankment, lurched forward again, and was suddenly doing a balancing act on both rails. "Of course, it takes the right car," said Eileen, with less tension and more confidence now. "Off we go." Off they went, balanced on the rails. The wheels were just the right width. A new sea gleamed silver on both sides. The car moved slowly, tottering and recovering, balancing like a dancer, the steering wheel moving constantly, minutely. Eileen was wire tense. "If you had told me, I wouldn't have believed it," Tim said. "I didn't think you'd get us up." Tim didn't answer. He saw very clearly that the tracks were dipping gradually toward the water, but whatever it was that he didn't believe now, he kept it to himself. Gliding, gliding over the sea. Eileen had been driving for hours over the water. Her slight frown, wide eyes, rigidly upright posture made her a closed universe. Tim dared not speak to her. There was nobody to call on them for help now, and nobody to point guns. The headlights and an occasional lightning bolt showed them only water and the rails. In places, the rails actually dipped below the water, and then Eileen slowed to a crawl and drove by feel. Once the lightning illuminated the roof of a large house, and six human forms on the peaked roof, all glistening in rain gear, 12 glinting eyes watching a phantom car drive across the water. And again there was a house, but it floated on its side, and nobody was near it. Once they drove for miles past a rectangular array of bushes, a drowned orchard with only the tops of the trees showing. "I'm afraid to stop," Eileen said. "I gathered that. I'm afraid to distract you." "No, talk to me. Don't let me get drowsy. Make me real, Tim. This is nightmarish." "God, yes. I'd know the surface of Mars at a glance, but this isn't any place in the universe. Did you see those people watching us?"
"Where?"
Of course, she dared not take her eyes off the rails. He told her about the six people on the roof.
"If they live," he said, "they'll start a legend about us, if anyone believes them."
"I'd like that."
"I don't know. A Flying Dutchman legend?"
But that was tactless.
"We won't be here forever, though. These tracks will take us as far as Porterville, and there won't be anyone trying to stop us."
"You think Senator Jellison will let you in, do you?"
"Sure."
Even if that hope failed them, they'd be in a safe area. What counted now was a magic trick, driving to Porterville on railroad tracks. He had to keep her mind on that. He was not expecting her next remark.
"Will he let me in?" "Are you crazy? You're a lot more valuable than I am. Remember the observatory?"
"Sure. After all, I'm such a damn good accountant."
"If they're as organized around Springville as they were in Tahunga, they'll need an accountant to take care of distributing goods. They may even have a barter system. That could get complicated, with money obsolete."
"Now you're the crazy one," Eileen said. "Anyone who does his own income tax can keep accounts. That's everyone but you, Tim. The accountants and the lawyers run this country, and they want everyone to be like them, and they've damn near succeeded."
"Not anymore."
"That's my point. Accountants are a drug on the market now."
"I don't go in without you," said Tim.
"Sure, I know that. The question is whether we go in or not. Are you hungry?"
"But of course I'm hungry, my child." Tim reached into the back seat. "Fritz gave us tomato bisque and chicken with rice. Both concentrated. I could put them in front of the heater. Can you drive with one hand?"
"I guess not. Not on this."
"Oh, never mind. We don't have a can opener."
Our thanks God for small miracles. They're easier to grasp. One small miracle was a road humping out of the sea to cross the tracks. Suddenly the tracks were sunk in blacktop, and Eileen stamped on the brake pedal almost hard enough to send Tim through the windshield. They flopped their seats back, rolled into each other's arms, and slept. Eileen's sleep wasn't calm. She jerked, she kicked, she cried out. Tim found that if he ran the palm of his hand down her spine, she would relax and fall back to sleep, and then he could sleep too, until next time. He woke in black night to the scream of wind and the panicky pressure of Eileen's fingernails and the perilous rocking of the car. Eileen's eyes were wide, her mouth too firmly set. "Hurricanes," he said. "The big ocean strikes'll keep spinning them off. Be glad we found a safe place first." She didn't react. "We're safe here," he repeated. "We can sleep through it." She laughed then. "I dare you. What happens if one of these hits us while we're on the tracks?"
"Then you'd better be as good as you think you are."
"Oh, Jesus," she said, and, incredibly, went back to sleep. Tim lay beside her in the howling and the rocking. Did hurricanes overturn cars? You bet they did. When he tired of thinking about that, he thought about how hungry he was. Maybe he could use the bumper to pry open a soup can after the hurricane passed. He dozed and woke in total silence. There wasn't even rain. He located a soup can and stepped outside. He managed to bend the bumper a little, but he also tore the soup can open. He swallowed some of the condensed tomato bisque, and that was how he happened to look up. He looked up into a wide patch of clear stars. "Beautiful," he said, but he entered the car in some haste. Eileen was sitting up. He gave her the soup can. "I think we're in the eye of the hurricane. If you want to see the stars, look quick and come back." "No thanks." The soup was cold and gluey. It left them both thirsty. Eileen set the can on the roof to collect rainwater, and they lay down again to wait for morning. The rain came again in frantic violence. Tim reached through the window for the can and found it gone. He found the abandoned beer can on the floor, pried it open, filled it twice in the rainwater streaming from the car roof. Hours later, the rain settled down to a gentle drumming. By then, it was full daylight, just enough dirty gray light to see that the sea around them was thick with floating things. There were corpses of dogs and rabbits and cattle, far outnumbered by the bodies of human beings. There was wood in all its forms, trees and furniture and the walls of houses. Tim got out and fielded some driftwood and set it in front of the car heater. "If we ever find shelter, we've still got that other can of soup," he said. "Good," said Eileen. She sat bolt upright at the steering wheel, and the motor was going. Tim didn't urge her. He knew better than to volunteer for the job, and he knew what it would cost her. She shifted into gear. "Hold it," Tim said, and he put a hand on her shoulder and pointed. She nodded and put the car back in neutral. A wave came toward them in a long thread of silver gray. It wasn't high. When it reached the car, it was no more than 2 feet tall. But the sea had risen in the night until it stood around the tires. The waves slapped against the car and lifted them and carried them and set them down almost immediately with the motor still going. Eileen sounded exhausted.
"What was that, another earthquake?"
"I'd say a dam collapsed somewhere."
"I see, only that." She tried to laugh. "The dam has broken. Run for your lives.
The Cherokees has escaped from Fort Mudge."
"What?"
"Pogo. Skip it," Tim said.
"All that water out there. This won't be the first dam that went. All of them, probably. Maybe here and there the engineers got spillways open in time."
"Maybe, but most of the dams are gone."
Which he thought means most of the electric power everywhere, not even local pockets of electricity. He wondered if the powerhouses and generators had survived. Dams could be built again. Eileen put the blazer into gear and started forward slowly. The Southern Pacific tracks took them most of the way to Porterville.
The tracks and embankment rose gradually, until what surrounded them was no longer sea, but land that looked as if it had recently risen from the depths. Atlantis returned. Still, Eileen kept to the tracks, though her shoulders were shivering with the strain.
"No people on the tracks, and no stalled cars," she said. "We're avoiding those, aren't we?"
They hadn't completely. Sometimes forlorn groups of refugees, usually in families, trudged along the right of way.
"I hate to leave them," Eileen said. "But which one should we take?"
"The first ones we see. Be selective. No matter what we do, we'd have the car filled and people on top, and there'd still be more." "It's all right," Tim said. "We don't have any place to go either." But he sat brooding, feeling her mood. What right did they have to expect anyone to help them? They weren't helping anyone themselves. South and east of Porterville, they rolled down a wet embankment to resume their trek on 190. Tim took over the driving, and Eileen lay in the reclined passenger seat, exhausted but unable to sleep. The land looked recently drowned. Studying the broken buildings and fences and uprooted trees, Tim became certain that a flood had come from the direction they were traveling. There was mud everywhere, and Tim had many occasions to feel proud of his judgment. He didn't think any other car in the world could have got them over some places they passed.
"Lake Success," Eileen said. "There was a big lake up there, and the dam must have gone. The road goes right past it."
"Yeah?"
"I'm wondering if there's any road there," she said.
They went on until they reached the junction that should have taken them up into the hills. The land was mud everywhere, studded with cars in every possible attitude. There were bodies, but no living human beings. They were glad for the rain. It kept them from seeing very far into the muddy ditch to their left. The road became worse, washed out in places, covered with mud in others. Eileen took over driving again, guessing where the road had been, and hoping it was still there, under the mud. The blazer kept moving, but more slowly. Then they saw the campfire. A half dozen cars, some as good as the blazer. Here were people of all sexes and ages, a gathering of the hopeless. Somehow they'd started a fire, and there was a pile of wood under a plastic shelter. The people stayed in the rain. Wood was kept near the fire to dry. Tim brought in the dry wood from the blazer. No one spoke to him. The children stared at him with hopeless eyes. Finally, one of the men said,
"You won't make it."
Tim wordlessly eyed the mudslide ahead. There were tracks in it. If any car could get through.
"This isn't the problem," the man said. "We got past that. But up ahead, there's a bridge out. So walk. And a man with a rifle. They don't talk. First shot was between my wife and myself. I got the impression the second would finish the job. Never even saw the rifleman." So that was it. End of the line.
Tim sat beside the fire and began to laugh, softly at first, then in rising hysteria. 2 days.
Two?
Yes. This was Friday. Drowned, muddy Friday after Hot Fudge Tuesday, and the roads to high ground were gone, and you couldn't get to the senator's place. More men with guns. The world belonged to men with guns. Maybe the senator was shooting. The image was funny. Senator Jellison in full formals, striped trousers and morning coat, and rifle, what the successful leader will wear.
"It works," Tim said. "Tell your dream and kill it. It works."
He laughed again.
"Here."
Another man, big, with thick, hairy forearms, used a handkerchief to snatch a tin can from the fire. He poured into a styrofoam cup, then looked regretful and took a flat pint bottle from his jacket pocket. He splashed in rum, then handed Tim the cup.
"Drink that, and don't lose the cup. And stop it. You're scaring the kids."
So what? But it was natural for Tim to feel ashamed. "Don't make a scene." How often had his mother told him that, and told his father that, and told everyone else? The laced coffee tasted good and warmed him. It didn't help much, though. Eileen brought their remaining can of soup and offered it.
They sat in silence, sharing what there was, the soup, instant coffee, and a bit of drowned rabbit broiled on a stick. There was very little talking. Finally, the others got up.
"We'll strike for north," one man said. He gathered his family. "Anybody with me?"
"Sure."
Others joined. Tim felt relieved. They were going away, leaving him with Eileen. Should he go with them? For what? They hadn't any place to go either. The others got up and went to their cars, all but the big man who'd offered the coffee. He sat with his wife and two children.
"You too, Brad?"
the new leader asked.
"Car's not working."
He waved toward a Lincoln parked near the mudslide.
"Broken axle, I think."
"Any gas in it?"
the leader asked.
"Not much." "We'll try anyway, if you don't mind."
The big man shrugged. The others siphoned no more than a pint of gasoline out of the Lincoln. Their cars were already crowded. There was absolutely no room for anyone else. The expedition leader paused. He looked at them as one looks at the dead.
"That's your plastic tarp and your instant coffee," he said.
He said it wistfully, but when he got no answer, turned away. They drove off, downhill into the rain. Now there were six by the fire, Tim and Eileen and...
"Name's Brad Wagoner," the big man said. "That's Rosa and Eric and Concepcion. Named the boy from my side of the family, girl for Rosa's. Thought we'd keep that up if we had any more."
He seemed glad of someone to talk with.
"I'm Eileen, and that's Tim. We're..."
She stopped herself.
"Of course, we're not really pleased to meet you, but I guess I should say it anyway. And we're very grateful for the coffee."
The children were very quiet. Rosa Wagoner hugged them and spoke to them in soft Spanish. They were very young, 5 or 6, not more, and they clung to her. They had on yellow nylon windbreakers and tennis shoes. "You're stranded," Tim said. Wagoner nodded. He still didn't say anything. "He'd make two of me," Tim thought, "and he's got a wife and 2 kids. We better get out of here before he breaks my neck and takes the blazer." Tim felt afraid and was ashamed because the Wagoners hadn't said or done anything to deserve suspicion. Just that they were here.
"No place to go anyway," Brad Wagoner said. "We're from Bakersfield. Not much left of Bakersfield. I guess we should have struck up into the hills right off, but we thought we'd try to find some supplies in town. We just missed getting washed away when the dam went."
He eyed the steep hill above him.
"If this rain would stop, maybe we could see some place to walk to. You got any plans?"
He couldn't disguise the plea in his voice.
"Not really."
Tim stared into the dying fire.
"I thought I knew somebody up there. Politician I gave a lot of money to. Senator Jellison."
There. That finished it for sure. And now what would they do?
"Jellison," Wagoner mused. "I voted for him. Think that would count? Are you still going to try to get up there?"
"It's all I can think of."
Tim's voice held no hope at all.
"What will you do?"
Eileen asked. Her eyes kept straying to the children. Wagoner shrugged.
"Find some place and start over, I guess."
He laughed.
"I built high-rise apartments, made a lot of money at it, but I didn't get as good a car as yours."
"You'd be surprised what that one cost me," Tim said. The fire died away. It was time. Eileen went to the blazer. Tim followed. Brad Wagoner sat with his wife and children.
"I can't stand it," Tim said.
"Me either."
Eileen took his hand and squeezed.
"Mr. Wagoner?"
"Brad?"
"Yeah."
"Come on. Pile in."
Eileen waited until the Wagoners had got into the blazer. Adults in the back seat, children on the floor behind that. She turned and drove down the hill.
"I wish we had a good map."
"Maps I have," Wagoner said.
He took out a soggy paper from an inner pocket.
"Careful, it tears easy when it's wet."
It was an auto club map of Tulare County, much better than the chevron map they'd been using. Eileen eased the blazer to a stop and examined the map.
"That bridge there, is that the one that's out?"
"Yeah."
"Look, Tim, If we backtrack and go south, there's a road up into the hills.
Which beats hell out of spending more time on the Southern Pacific, Tim said.
Southern Pacific? Rosa Wagoner asked.
Tim didn't explain. They drove south until they found a sheltered place on the road, partway up a hill, and they pulled off to sleep. They took turns letting the Wagoners use the seats while they huddled under the plastic tarp.
High ground, Tim said. It goes north and east, and that road's not on the map.
He pointed. The road was gravel, but it looked in good condition, and it looked traveled. It ran in the right direction. Eileen was running out of hope, and the blazer was running out of gas, but she took the road. It wound upward into the hills. It was luck that they'd found it, and more luck that the rain and mud and hurricanes hadn't ruined it, but no luck could protect them from the roadblock. There were four big men, big like football stars or TV mafia goons. Guns and size made them look unfriendly, and they weren't smiling. Tim got out alone, wonderingly. One of the men came down to meet him. The others stood aloof. One of the men looked elusively familiar. Someone he'd seen on the senator's ranch. That wouldn't help, and it was another of the armed men who had come to the barrier. Tim told them crisply, while very aware of how like a wandering tramp he looked.
"We're on our way to visit Senator Jellison."
The imperious voice cost Tim most of his reserves of self-control. It hadn't impressed.
"Name?"
"Tim Hamner."
The man nodded.
"Spelled how?"
Tim spelled it and was somehow glad that the name was not known. The man called behind him.
"Chuck, see if Hamner's on the senator's list. H-A-M-N-E-R.
One of the guards reacted to that. He came down toward the barricade. Tim was sure he'd seen him before.
"We've got a list of people to let through," the first guard said. "And, buddy, it's a short list. We've got another list of professions. Are you a doctor?"
"No."
"Blacksmith?"
"Machinist?"
"Mechanic."
"Tool and die maker?"
"What have you got for playboy, retired, or astronomer?"
Tim remembered Brad Wagoner.
"Or building contractor?"
He had a thought as he said it, but he was interrupted. A voice came from a parked truck.
"No, Hamner."
"Sorry," the guard said.
"We don't want you blocking the road, so we'd be obliged if you'd move that car to where we can't see it. And don't come back."
"If you tell your dreams, they won't come true." Tim started to turn away, but you don't go off to die without even trying. He saw Eileen and Rosa Wagoner staring out at him from the car. Their faces said it all. They knew. Other roads in? Nuts. The car was almost out of gas. And suppose they found one. These people knew the country. If there was a good way in, they had it covered. Walk? Senator Jellison's ranch ended at a great white monolith the size of an apartment building, and maybe they could get that far and get shot. And anyway, Tim thought, if I'm good for anything, it's talking. No use at all creeping around in the bushes. He turned back to the barricade. The guard looked disappointed. His rifle wasn't quite pointed at Tim.
"Your car works fine, and you're not hurt," the man said. "I'd leave it at that."
"Chescu!" Tim shouted. "Mark Chescu!"
"That's Chescu," one of the men answered.
"Hello, Mr. Hamner." "You were going to let me leave? Without even talking to me?"
Mark shrugged.
"I'm not really in charge here."
"Fucking A, you're not," one of the big men said.
"But, Mark, can we talk?" Tim demanded. "I have an idea."
He thought fast. There was something Wagoner had said. He built apartments. But,
"We can talk," Mark told him. "It won't do a lot of good."
He handed his rifle to one of the others and came around the barrier.
"What's to talk about?"
Tim led him to the blazer.
"Brad, you said you built apartments. Contractor or architect?"
"Both."
"I thought so," Tim said.
He spoke quickly, words in a rush.
"So you know concrete and construction work. You could build a dam."
Wagoner frowned.
"I suppose."
"See?"
Tim was triumphant.
"Dams!"
He pointed to the auto club map.
See? There are powerhouses, dams, all along the road up from here, all the way up into the Sierra, and those dams will be gone. But some of the little powerhouses will still be there, and I know enough about electricity to get them running if somebody can build the dam. You have here a complete electrical contracting team. That ought to be worth something.
Tim was lying through his teeth, but he didn't think any of these people would know enough about electricity to trip him in an exam. And he did know the theory, even if he was a bit hazy about the practical aspects of polyphase alternators. Mark looked thoughtful.
"God damn it!" Tim shouted. "I gave Jellison $50,000 back when that was real money. You can at least tell him I'm here."
"Yeah, let me think about it," Mark said. The story made sense, and Tim Hamner had been a friend of Harvey Randall's. If Hamner had gone off without recognizing him, Mark could have forgotten that, but not now. Harv would find out, and Harv might not like it. And 50 big ones. Mark hadn't spent much time with the senator, but Jellison had this old-fashioned air, and he might think that was important. And besides, that bit about dams and powerhouses, it added up. Mark would have to let them in. Only he couldn't. The Christophers wouldn't let him. But they still listened to Jellison. Mark eyed the other man in the car. A big man.
"Army?"
he asked.
"Marine Corps,"
Wagoner said.
"Can you shoot?"
"All Marines are riflemen first."
"Yes."
"Okay, I'll give it a try."
Mark went back to the roadblock.
"This guy seems to be an old friend of the senator's," Mark said. "I'll go tell him."
The big guard looked thoughtful. Tim held his breath.
"He can wait,"
the man said finally. He raised his voice.
"Pull off to the side and stay in the car."
"Right."
Tim got into the Blazer. They jockeyed it until it was almost in the ditch. "If somebody comes here in a fighting mood, we don't want to get hit by stray bullets," he said. He watched Mark kick a motorcycle to life and drive away.
"Is fighting likely?"
Rosa Wagoner asked.
"I don't know,"
Tim said. He huddled in the seat.
"Now we wait and see."
Eileen laughed. She pictured Tim trying to rewind a huge generator.
"Cross your fingers," she said.
"You knew him, I didn't," Senator Jellison said. "Any use?"
Harvey Randall looked thoughtful.
"I honestly don't know. He got here. That's a lot in his favor. He's a survivor."
"Oh, lucky," Jellison said. "Hamner, as in Hamner Brown. He wasn't lucky for the world. Yeah, I know, discovery isn't invention. Mark, you say the other guy's an ex-Marine?"
"Says he is."
"Looks it, Senator. That's all I know."
6 more people. 2 women and 2 kids."
Jellison looked thoughtful.
"Harvey, you put any stock in this scheme to get the power plants working again?"
"The idea sounds useful."
"Sure, but can Hamner do it?"
Harvey shrugged.
"I honestly don't know, Senator. He's a college man. He must know something besides astronomy."
"And I owe him," Jellison said. "Question is, do I owe him enough? It can get hungry here this winter."
He looked thoughtful again.
"The guy who discovered the comet. That tells me one thing. He's probably got patience. And we could sure as hell use a lookout up on top of the crag. Somebody who'd really watch. Let Alice move around a bit instead of sticking in one place. And a Marine who may or may not be able to build dams. Officer or enlisted, Mark?"
"Don't know, Senator. I guess officer, but I just don't know."
"Yeah, well, I always did like the Marines. Mark, go tell Mr. Hamner this is his lucky day."
Mark's face said it all. Tim knew when Mark came to the car. They were safe. After all of it, they were safe. Sometimes dreams do come true, even if you tell them.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook, so please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.